everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm joined as usual by my co-host, Adrian Bloom, editorial director of the magazine, and Bob Ferguson, president of Strategic Consulting. So welcome, as always, to y'all.
Hi, Stacey.
So Adrian, we're just going to get right to it here. So Adrian, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we've got in store for today's interview?
Yeah, so today I am speaking with Dr. Kea Mukherjee and Dr. Vittorio Fattori. They're both food safety specialists in the Food Systems and Food Safety Division of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, or FAO as it's called for short. So it was a big pleasure to speak with FAO, and especially Dr. Mukherjee and Dr. Fattori, who've been involved in researching and writing so many of the organization's critical reports on emerging threats to global food safety, novel food sources, and others. Now, you might remember some of the excellent articles they've prepared for us over the past couple of years, so I think you'll find this to be an insightful deep dive into some of those article topics.
So as usual, you want to stay tuned for Adrian's great discussion with those respected folks from FAO. And as we've been doing in the lead up to this year's Food Safety Summit being held May 8th through the 11th in Rosemont, Illinois, I've been highlighting some of the features that we've got planned for you guys at the summit. And today I'm going to share some of the details on our Got Root Cause workshop. And I don't know about you guys, but sometimes when I'm reading stuff, I'll print it out and read through and then make, underlines and this and that. This time I was reading this and I was just making giant exclamation points in the margins because I got so excited about what we're talking about and the terrific lineup. So I'm so excited about this workshop. I know we all are, actually. It's such an important topic. Exploring the problem-solving methods used to identify the underlying cause or causes of issues, and then properly identify appropriate solutions and resolve them permanently. So despite its importance, many folks are still view root cause analysis as a complex and confusing process. So this three-hour workshop is designed to demystify the process by breaking it down into simple, easy to understand steps. It will also shed light on regulatory expectations for the investigative process, due diligence needed for any investigation, and provide insights on best practices for successful implementation currently used within the industry. The workshop will also review why it's critical to get to the root cause using tools like the five whys or fishbone diagrams. Discussion will focus on essential information needed to launch an investigation, who to involve in the investigative process, what type of data should be reviewed, and how to avoid bias as you work to formulate your hypotheses, and then, of course, very important, the monitoring activities needed to verify effective corrective and preventive actions. So then we get to the subject matter experts, and this is where I got my giant exclamation points going. We've got Tim Jackson, Senior Science Advisor at FDA, Tim King, founder of Quality Matters, Angie Siemens, Vice President of Food Safety, Quality, and Regulatory at Cargill, John Butts, legendary Seek and Destroy, John Butts, Natalie Dianson, Vice President of Food Safety and Quality Assurance at Dole, and Deb Kane, Vice President, Food Safety, Quality, and Regulatory at J&J Snack Foods. Plus, moderators Brendan Namira, Research Leader at USDA ARS, and Robert Prevendar, Director of Global Food Safety and Quality Assurance at Yum Brands. What a lineup.
Stacey, if I could, this could not be better timed. I can tell you in a lot of the interviews I've been doing, more and more people are telling me that they are mandated to get to the root cause, the idea of finding a positive, wondering what happened, and not getting to a root cause and a corrective action is not allowed anymore. And more companies are doing a lot more environmental monitoring with this in the mind. But I'm not sure everybody knows all of the tools available to them. So I'm telling you, just from the discussions I'm having with processors, this couldn't be better timed.
Yeah. And I didn't go into all the detail, but I mean, it's a really hands-on workshop. People are going to come out with a totally actionable knowledge. And even if it's a refresher, I think it's designed for people at all levels of expertise. So just a tremendous lineup of people. So to learn more, you can visit foodsafetysummit.com to get all the details on the great courses, workshops, and sessions that our impressive education advisory board has lined up for you. If you register before March 31st, which is TikTok coming up now, so by March 31st, you can still get the early bird discount. And if you couple that with our very special discount for our podcast audience, which is FSM23 Podcast, you save another 10% on top of the early bird. That code will work even after the early bird, but why not stack it up and save? And don't forget, we also have great offers for groups, so you can bring your whole team, as quite a few people do, and we really look forward to seeing you there. And we made it, Adrian. We made it to the news.
Yes, we did. We have made it to the news. And so
I hope we make it through the news, because there's a lot here. But
We do have a lot of interesting news to discuss with you today. And first in our news lineup, we have a breakthrough announcement from EPA on PFAS. So in mid-March, EPA issued a pre-publication draft of a final rule that would regulate maximum levels of six types of PFAS as contaminants in drinking water. Now, in March 2021, EPA already issued a determination to regulate perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA, and also perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, or PFOS, under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Now, this new announcement would see the regulation of four new types of PFAS as contaminants. So these are perfluorohexane sulfonic acid, hexafluoropropylene oxide dimer acid with ammonium salt, perfluoronononoic acid, and perfluorobutane sulfonic acid. So mixtures of these four PFAS will also be regulated. Now, EPA is also proposing a national primary drinking water regulation and maximum contaminant level goals for the four newly regulated PFAS types and their mixtures, as well as for the two previously regulated types of PFAS. Now, considering the available analytical methods to measure and treat PFOA and PFOS in drinking water, EPA is proposing individual maximum contaminant levels of 4 nanograms per liter for PFOA and PFOS. Meanwhile, EPA is proposing to use a hazard index approach to protect public health from mixtures of the four new PFAS added to the Safe Drinking Water Act because of their known toxic effects and their likely co-occurrence in drinking water. EPA is proposing a hazard index of 1 as the maximum contaminant level goal for the four PFAS, as well as any mixture containing one or more of the chemicals. EPA is requesting comments on its draft regulation, and it will also be holding a public hearing on May 4th, where the public can provide comments on the rule proposal. Now, we know PFAS has been the subject of much attention in both the media and the scientific worlds lately. We also reported recently on a study from Notre Dame researchers on the presence of PFAS in fluorinated high-density polyethylene, or HDPE, plastic containers that are used for the packaging of pesticides and consumer goods and that can be used for food packaging. Now, the researchers conducted this study following an EPA report demonstrating that HDPE containers contribute to high levels of PFAS in pesticides. This research is the first to measure the ability of PFAS to leach from HDPE containers into food and the effect of temperature on the leaching process. Now, during this study, the researchers found that HDPE packaging contained parts per billion levels of PFAS that could migrate into both solvents and food in as little as 1 week. Additionally, PFAS was found in olive oil, ketchup, and mayonnaise that had been in contact with fluorinated HDPE containers for 7 days at various temperatures. Now, based on the levels of PFAS found in the food samples, the Notre Dame researchers estimate that ingesting food stored in fluorinated HDPE containers is a significant risk of exposure to PFAS.
So this is a complicated topic. We could be here for hours talking about the implication of this. We won't stay here for hours and do that, I promise. But the numbers here are really, really small. For instance, the minimum reporting level that they have are parts per trillion, but the lifetime health advisory level is 1,000 times lower than that. So as far as what the health levels are, it's possible that a drinking water utility regulated by the EPA could say, we don't detect it at all in our water, but it certainly could be above that health advisory level. So exactly what that means is really difficult. The other thing is the minimum reporting level is in parts per trillion, but what Adrian just announced as far as what could leach from packaging is in parts per billion, or 1,000 times higher than what would be in drinking water, even if a utility exceeded that minimum reporting level. So the numbers here are various magnitudes, and what exactly would happen with this regulation if the utilities are able to reduce PFAS exposures may not be really where the big exposures are. But what the EPA is saying is two things. One is by reducing these levels, they're using a rationale essentially saying that lower is better. So if we can reduce these levels and do it in a reasonable way, that should be part of the goal. The one thing the EPA has not done yet is done a health risk reduction cost analysis, which they're required to do. And they'll talk about that a little bit on the public meeting in May. But that's not yet been done. So there may be some trade-offs here, and there are some fairly large numbers here. Another one I found going to the CDC website looking at this is that average blood levels for Americans for PFAS-related, I think it's just PFAS and PFOA, is 5 parts per billion. So the average person has in their blood more than what would be this reporting level, but those have come down respectively 85% and 75% since they first started taking the data in 2000. So you could say in that respect, this is getting better. I don't know where better goes to good or how low it has to be, but keep in mind, we're talking about some very, very low levels in water to the point where there aren't very, very many labs that even can analyze it that close. So this is a complicated thing to wrap your head around. At least for me, I think it is.
It is a very complicated issue, and I am happy to report that, you know, I looked at our website. I did a search for PFAS. We've covered it a lot over the last few years, so there's a lot there for our audience. If you want to go to our website, food-safety.com, and search for PFAS, you'll find a lot there. There's also a great article by one of our favorite contributors, Larry Keener, a process authority. And I reached out to Larry about this because actually he and I have talked a lot about this. And he even texted me when this came out, you know, very happy that that EPA is taking this action because drinking water and the safety of our drinking water is such an important issue on so, so many levels. He did an article for us, The Growing Challenge of Safe Water for Use in Food Processing Operations. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. So he examines a lot of different areas, but first and foremost, know where your water's coming from. You know, do an audit of your facilities. He was talking about when he was in charge of this, he audited all of his facilities. He knew where the water was coming from, and they tested it to see exactly what the makeup was. You know, is it private public wells? Is it municipal? Have relationships with your municipalities. And then specifically for PFAS, I guess there is some remediation that you can do through filtration, but he also mentioned, and then what? So now you've got this, what do you do? What do you do with it once you've collected it? What's the disposal process on that? As you mentioned, Bob, it's so complicated because this isn't the only issue that we're facing with our water supplies. And so it's a matter of what's the most important. As a consumer, as a person on this planet at this day and time, it's starting to feel a little bit close here about all the things that we're dealing with. And reading the article, another great article that was in Consumer Reports, you know, about why when they developed these products, it was because aren't they fantastic, you know, for their nonstick and stain-resistant properties, and it takes so long for them to break down in the environment. Well, guess what? So long is now. And I just feel like there's so many things that the bill is coming due on, right? So, Bob, to your point in our earlier discussion, everybody has to weigh that. But food processors are in a particular spot of being, you know, you really do need to monitor your systems and I think have a good profile of what's going on with one of your most important inputs of water. So, but surely there will be more on this and more clarification, because as you also point out too, the levels that they set exceed our current detectable abilities.
Larry Keener says a lot of brilliant things, but one of the things that he said to you was, know where your water comes from, but also you have an option as a processor. Okay, so PFAS is a global problem. It's all throughout the environment. We've been exposed to it for a really long time, but it doesn't mean as a processor that you can't do something about it. If it's needed to be done something about it in your area, you can test, you can find out what's going on, and there are remediation options where you can do something about it. So you don't have to solve the global problem, but you can solve the problem.
You can just solve your problem.
Solve your problem, exactly.
Yeah, and you can also solve your packaging problems. And, you know, we've talked about all the plastics that are breaking down and people are finding. So, you know, what are we innovating? How are we innovating? Are we making the right choices for today as well as tomorrow, things that aren't going to come due later down the road? And I think, you know, we're getting to that place where we realize, oh, to be more responsible and sustainable in the way we approach problems and solutions.
Yep, definitely a story to continue to watch, and we will continue to report on that for you. So next in our news lineup today, we want to discuss the letter that FDA sent to all businesses involved in the infant formula supply chain, calling for better assurance in the safety of their food. Now, the letter came from FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf and CIFSAN Director Dr. Susan Main, and it was sent in response to the infant formula safety and supply crisis that marked much of 2022, which we've discussed several times on the podcast prior. Now, the letter was dated March 8th, and it reflects conversations between FDA and infant formula manufacturers in 2023 about industry's current food safety practices and opportunities for improvement. In the letter, FDA is asking infant formula manufacturers to reevaluate their process controls, ensure full compliance with all regulations, consider special food safety concerns explained in the letter, and adhere to requirements about notifications for adulterated or misbranded products. FDA also asked manufacturers to voluntarily notify the agency anytime a product sample is found to be positive for Cronobacter or Salmonella, even if the affected product has not been distributed. FDA also wants manufacturers to better control water in dry production areas, verify the effectiveness of process controls through environmental monitoring, and identify all relevant biological hazards and implement effective supply chain controls for those. So, bottom line, a lot of voluntary requests of infant formula manufacturers, despite the deaths of several infants from the same pathogen, although no genetic evidence was able to link the infant deaths with the specific supplier's products, as well as a prolonged supply crisis and an internal investigation and critical report from FDA on the incident. So I think the voluntary part of the request to do better is interesting, given that infants are a particularly vulnerable population because they rely on one food source. So Bob, Stacy, what do you think?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to this. What's that saying these days? A lot to unpack in this whole infant formula story, but particularly this letter. The one thing I'm going to focus on is in the letter, he said the FDA has identified following areas for improvement. Number three in that one, in that list is implementing appropriate corrective actions following the isolation of a pathogen from an environmental sample or product sample. That's called root cause analysis. We were talking about that earlier, and there may be a place to learn more about that. Now, I'm going to say, Stacy didn't know I was going to bring this up. This is not said in text, but...
Well, the check's in the mail, Bob.
All right, thanks. But the other thing about this, so now I'll get into sort of the cynical thing I was going to say, is so you have root cause analysis, find out exactly what happened so that you can implement corrective actions and put these things back and make sure that these things don't happen again. But what has happened here in this case? Do we actually know what the root cause analysis was of this issue? Do we know exactly where it came from? I think there's still a lot of questions there. And I think there's a lot of questions from people on exactly what happened. So if you go back to this letter, and I don't want to be overly critical, you know, first off, there's the handful of things that Adrian read that in the recommendations from the FDA essentially sounded to me like, you know, follow the law. That's probably a pretty good advice there, but there's nothing really shocking here, or it should be shocking to food safety professionals on what they're asking to be done. But the one thing that they're asking to be done, I think, has not been done in this case yet. What exactly happened, and where is the route of exposure? Since, again, as Adrian mentioned, the genetic markers don't match. There's some controversy on exactly what happened. I think there's a lot more to find out about what's happening here. But the FDA is doing the right thing to remind people, maybe raise awareness raise the awareness level of the people in infant formula. So if there are issues with dry areas versus, you know, keeping dry areas dry, which I think is kind of food safety 101, those kind of things certainly should be paid more attention to. Maybe we're making people pay attention to something they haven't been. I don't know if that's the case, but it's good to highlight this. But if you were to implement all these things in a real world area, there should not be that much change happening, yet we still don't know, you know, what the exact root cause is, and maybe there's something else that needs to be done.
Well, they also talked about increasing the time, or I should say shortening the time span on inspections for these right. facilities to 1 year as opposed to three
right.
for the, quote, high risk. And then the voluntary reporting, if you've found it, that part, how does that really work? Oh, you know, you raise your hand. Yes, we found it. And then what? I don't know. So it, like you said, there's going to be a lot to play out here. But boy, what a dust up. I mean, from day one. And then the letter from FDA. Then Bill Marlowe's response has been interesting, and then Susan Main's response to Bill's response, and I'm sure we're not done yet. I guess it is nice to see them engaging so much. You know, that's I think that's been the part too, is even engaging in some of these, you know, public responses and stuff. So I think that that's encouraging. I think it's a very important thing. They a lot of the stuff that people want to see happen, as Susan Main points out, is not within their control. You know, putting Coronabacter on the reportable disease, you know, not up to them. So as you read through the, we could again spend a long time on this topic, but if you read through those letters, I think that things are very well documented about what can and can't be done now, and who's responsible for that, and you know. Parts is for Congress to decide. But the ball is definitely rolling here, so we're definitely going to keep watching this and see. And you also mentioned that Frank is going to be testifying too.
So I, right before we started to record, I saw on LinkedIn that there is a congressional hearing on Tuesday. So that's the last week in March. Let me get
so the day that this episode drops.
Right. So, okay. So today there's the testimony in front of Congress at 10 a.m. So if you're listening to this early enough, you can tune in mm-hmm. and see this. I don't know everyone who's testifying, but it's on this particular topic. It's on mm-hmm. all on infant formula. So
yeah.
I'll be tuning in.
Well, we'll definitely keep reporting on this. So.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So looking to the next story that we want to talk about in our news lineup for today, and also related to government news on pathogen concerns, we have a story out of Canada. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency, or CFIA, has published a guidance document for the pathogen reduction monitoring program for Salmonella and Campylobacter in raw poultry. Now, Canadian poultry processors who hold Safe Foods for Canadians licenses are expected to begin following this new guidance by April 1st of this year. The results of this program will support CFIA in developing Canadian food safety performance standards. So, Canadian poultry processors must identify and analyze the biological, chemical, and physical contamination hazards in their food operations and then prevent, eliminate, or reduce them to an acceptable level using effective control measures. CFIA standards for maximum pathogen limits in raw poultry are derived from Canadian microbiological surveys, Salmonella and Campylobacter performance standards verification testing developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and also Canadian meat license holder test results. So I think this is an interesting story because it sounds like it's a little bit in line with what USDA is aiming for with its proposed regulatory framework for reducing salmonella in poultry, especially with the heavy emphasis on process control and the ultimate goal being to implement enforceable final product standards.
Yeah, Adrian, from what I've read here, this is certainly a first step in that process. It's primarily a data gathering effort to support their further level setting operations, what they're going to do. And processors can follow the sampling guidelines by using their existing samples. So the number of samples that people have to take to comply with this is not very high. It's a number of samples per year. But I would guess that most Canadian processors are probably already taking those samples and will be able to use their existing sampling, just making it available to CFIA. They started doing interim standards in February earlier this year. And then the data collected in this part of the study will be used to guide the final standards. The interim goals that they have in that February standard are pretty comparable to USDA goals. Some are a little higher, some are a little lower, but they're pretty comparable. So I don't think this will be, it doesn't seem to be too onerous. It'd be interesting to hear from processors if I'm wrong about that. But I don't think this is too onerous, but it will guide further standard setting, which is good to have that data to at least use data in the regulatory process.
Yep, absolutely, Bob. And so before we go, now, given that our interview today is with FAO, we'd like to dive a little deeper into the theme of FAO's fifth annual World Food Safety Day on June 7th. And the theme is Food Standards Save Lives. Now, we mentioned that briefly on the last episode, but we might not have mentioned that FAO has released all kinds of resources to help your organization or company commemorate this very important day, including a video, which we'll link in the show notes, explaining how global factors are affecting the food supply and food safety, and how food safety needs to be prioritized as agri-food systems change with the times. You'll get to hear about some of these topics in our interview today, too, so this is just another great resource for you to check out. So FAO and the World Health Organization have also published an online guide to World Food Safety Day 2023 that explains the importance of food standards in protecting public health, including Codex Alimentarius standards, as well as some ideas for messaging and participation in World Food Safety Day. We'll also include the link to that in the show notes for you, so make sure to check out these resources from FAO and WHO for some good information and ideas for World Food Safety Day on June 7th.
Yes, they're fantastic resources. And that brochure, the guide, it's really great. The guide is like 8 pages. There's really great information. And it's fun to see. I think that they're really noticing that World Food Safety Day is really raising awareness around the world. So it's a great thing to participate in. You can get all the facts, all the supports in the show notes. So as always, check out all the links. I think we've talked about a lot of stuff that we're going to have in those show notes. You guys are going to be busy accessing all of that stuff. But great information there, great resources, great articles to check out. And you know, I also like to remind you to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And to take a deeper dive into all the great content that we offer, visit our website at food-safety.com.
Oh, wait, now it sounds like there's two dashes. Oh, no. We don't want people to type the dashes. Wrong address.
There can never be enough dashes.
Yeah, well, maybe just one dash.
Just one dash.
Okay. And now it's time for Adrian's interview with Dr. Kaya Mukherjee and Dr. Vittorio Fattori. Dr. Kaya Mukherjee is a food safety specialist with the Food Systems and Food Safety Division of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO. Kaya coordinates the division's work on food safety foresight, where she uses futures thinking to identify and evaluate new trends and drivers with varying impacts on the global food safety landscape. She's authored a number of publications on some of the key emerging areas in food safety. Kaya is also part of the FAO Secretariat of the Joint FAO-WHO Expert Committee on Food Additives, a body that provides independent scientific advice on various food additives, veterinary drugs, and contaminants to different Codex Alimentarius committees and FAO member countries. Kaya holds a PhD in biochemistry from Texas A&M, a master's degree in biotechnology from the University of Essex, and a bachelor's degree in life sciences from Ramnarayan Ruia College. Dr. Vittorio Fattori is a food safety officer at the Food Systems and Food Safety Division of FAO, where he both coordinates the Foresight Program on emerging food safety issues and provides scientific advice. In particular, some of his focus areas include evaluating how new trends and drivers of change can affect food safety in order to proactively respond to risks, as well as optimize opportunities. He also works in the Secretariat of the Joint FAO-WHO Expert Committee on Food Additives to provide scientific advice to Codex Alimentarius, FAO members, and other UN agencies on food additives, contaminants, and residues of veterinary drugs in food, and providing technical guidance on food safety, regulatory, and emerging issues. Before joining FAO, Vittorio worked in research laboratories both in academia and in the private sector in the UK, Japan, and US. His research activities have focused on the assessment of food safety risks posed by contaminants and pesticides. He also spent time in Africa, where his work in a rural community has further impressed upon him the need for guidance and support concerning food safety and public health. And now, here's that interview.
So today I am here with Dr. Kea Mukherjee, who's a food safety specialist at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, or FAO as it's called, within the Food Systems and Food Safety Division, and also Dr. Vittorio Frattori, who's also a food safety officer at the Food and Agriculture Organization, also within the Food Systems and Food Safety Division. Now, Kea and Vittorio, you guys wrote some excellent articles for us recently. In our December-January edition, just a little while ago, you wrote our cover story, which was Applying Foresight to Navigate Opportunities and Challenges Amid an Evolving Food Safety Landscape. And then back in the June-July issue of last year, you wrote our category feature, which was on new food sources and food production systems, exploring the food safety angle. And I know that a lot of the data that was in those two articles was based on some really rich research and analysis from some of the foresight reports that FAO has put out. And I know that you've got a lot of information to share about that. And that is what we are going to talk about in this interview today. So let's jump right in with talking about some of these subjects that we've heard about in the articles. So, first question for you, considering the novel foods that FAO is looking into, such as insects and cell-based or lab-grown meat, are some of the promising alternative protein sources. So what would you say are some of the safety and quality concerns that are associated with each of these new food types? And, you know, how can producers and processors of foods such as these address these concerns?
Hello, Adrian, and thank you for introducing me. Many of the food safety concerns that are linked to both insects and the cell-based foods actually apply to a number of foods in general that we see out in the markets today. But there are some that are quite unique to these proteins, and those are the ones that require much closer attention by the food safety authorities. The health risks that are associated with insects are important considerations, as most of the insects tend to be consumed in their entirety. So these concerns really depend on the species of insects. What feed are they being reared upon? How are they reared, processed, harvested, etc.? And we have covered some of these various hazards, as you said, in our 2021 publication, which is, of course, available on our website. In general, insects that are reared and harvested under controlled hygienic conditions will pose fewer risks than those that are maybe collected from the wild, let's say. According to literature, there are certain microbiological species like Salmonella, Campylobacter, endospore-forming bacteria, even certain fungal species like Aspergillus that can be found linked to these commercially important insects and therefore can cause health impacts. But microbial risks can be greatly reduced when food hygiene practices are followed through the various stages of production, processing, and of course at the retail level itself. If the insects are raised on, let's say, agricultural waste, then they may be exposed to toxins like mycotoxins or agrochemicals like antimicrobials or pesticides. These chemicals may also bioaccumulate in insects, But it is important to remember that the life cycle itself of the insects is quite short. So the potential for great bioaccumulation may be much lower. But the most important hazard to pay attention to with respect to insects is really the allergenic potential of insect-based foods. People with allergy to shellfish may be predisposed to some allergens that are in insects due to cross-reactivity. And there's also an emerging concern of new allergic risks developing due to de novo sensitization of yet unidentified allergens from insects. As for the cell-based food, we did have a recent technical panel that was organized by FAO, where all the possible hazards linked to cell-based foods were considered. And they found that many of the hazards are well known and exist in conventionally produced animal products. The four main areas to consider for food safety concerns for cell-based foods fall under four stages. So first would be concerns that arise during cell sourcing, cell growth and production, cell harvesting, and at the end, the processing aspect of it. Some of the specific concerns include, for instance, the use of animal serum-based culture media, particularly with fetal bovine serum, which is currently one of the most commonly used, as they can present a high risk for microbiological contamination. Others can arise from additives like cryoprotectants, for instance, that are used for cell storage, and they can be unintentionally carried over into the final products. They can be residues that are left over from potential use of antimicrobial agents, for instance. They can also be allergenic potential as some of the scaffolds that they use that can, if they're derived, for instance, from chitin or chitosan. And actually, to cover all of this, FAO has produced a video that shows the various food safety measures that are used in the production of, for instance, cell-based steak at a facility in Israel. And this is available on our website for anybody who's curious.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Kaya, for explaining that. And we'll definitely include the link to that video in the show notes so that people can go watch that for themselves. Now, another food that is often grouped into novel foods, although it's something that is widely eaten in certain parts of the world, is seaweed. And, you know, it's because it's growing in diets around other parts of the world as well. And when looking at seaweeds, we know that heavy metals uptake by seaweeds is an issue, just as it is with terrestrial agricultural products. So my first question for you dealing with this food type is, what are some methods for addressing metals accumulation in seaweed as a newer food source?
Yeah, thanks, Adrian. So while certain heavy metals are, they're actually known food safety hazards, right? So we have lead, we have mercury, there's cadmium. In seaweeds in particular, the food safety significance lies in the fact that this particular food commodity can bioaccumulate these metals. So this bioaccumulation is dependent on a lot of different factors, like the presence of the heavy metal itself in the environment, of course, and the seaweed species in question. So for instance, cadmium has been found to occur at much higher levels in red as opposed to brown seaweeds, while the opposite is true for mercury. Also, since seaweed is mostly sold dried, the levels of heavy metals in such products can be much higher. So it is estimated about 5 to 10 times higher than fresh seaweed, according to some estimates. So as you said, the consumption of seaweed is rising. And with this rise, regulatory frameworks are really urgently needed to safeguard consumer health. But at this point, there is a general lack of intake data. And by that, I mean quantities, frequencies, mode of use, for instance, that are currently hampering our exposure assessment. While widespread legislative limits for such metals in seaweed for food has not yet been set, there are efforts that are being undertaken by various national agencies to evaluate the safety considerations of seaweed as food, for instance, in France, also by the Food Standards Australia, New Zealand presents. Some national agencies also, for instance, caution consumers to avoid certain seaweed products due to high levels of certain heavy metals. For instance, the Norwegian food safety authorities had advised consumers to avoid Laminaria digita due to high levels of inorganic arsenic. Some basic methods, such as washing and soaking, for instance, have been found to reduce arsenic content in food. And the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries had recommended the steps to reduce arsenic in certain edible seaweed species as well. FAO and WHO actually are working together with a number of experts around the world to highlight these major food safety hazards that are linked to the consumption of seaweed. And we actually had a major publication on this topic released last year, and I will, of course, provide you with the link so that readers can find that.
Great. Thank you, Kaya. And, you know, another thing with seaweed is that it's also been shown to be a vector for microplastics. So how can processing operations ensure that microplastics on seaweed surfaces are removed for safe consumption?
Yeah, that's a good question. Microplastics can adhere to seaweeds. And of course, microplastics in turn can be vectors for other chemical and microbiological agents. Studies have shown that washing can significantly decrease the amount of microplastics in seaweeds. But currently, there's insufficient evidence to really fully characterize the presence of microplastics in seaweeds. And there are no legal limits set yet. This is an area that is evolving. We are looking into it as well. And we expect to see some more information coming out in due course.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Kaya. I'd like to zoom out a little bit and go a little broader with some concepts. Now, according to the horizon scanning approach that you use in your Foresight program, what are some of the greatest threats to food safety from the warming climate? And what can food safety professionals do to monitor and mitigate some of these growing threats?
Adrian, this is a really heavyweight kind of a question. Because climate impacts are so varied and their effects can be felt all along the food chain. At the farm level, for instance, droughts and extreme rainfall can bring about separate sets of food safety hazards. At the aquaculture level, rising temperatures and increasing carbon dioxide concentrations can cause a lot of damage in the aquatic ecosystem and pose food safety concerns. Climate impacts can also cause disruptions of the coal food chain, for instance, and that can affect the food quality and safety as the food travels from a distribution point to the retail level. Just taking one single variable of, say, rising temperatures, we can see a really wide range of impacts on food safety, from increasing incidence of foodborne pathogens to making plants more susceptible to fungal infections and mycotoxin formation, to expansion of harmful algal blooms across our global coastlines and lakes. Some of these hazards have been reviewed by us, and we have kind of distilled that in our 2020 publication, which can be found on our website. As per what kind of steps can we take, widespread early warning systems and robust monitoring and surveillance networks really are the key here, especially in countries that are grappling with climate impacts more than some of the other countries. The success of such systems is highly dependent on increased gathering of these climate impact data on food safety hazards, followed by exchange and transparency in the sharing of this data. This is something that as a food safety community, we still need to work on. Sometimes data is only collected when there's an outbreak, but for instance, this really misses out on opportunities to track emergence of new pathogens. Another aspect is to complement surveillance with forward-looking approaches like Foresight, which will help to identify emerging food safety concerns. Lastly, and very importantly, is to really shift the way we think. It is to view climate change impacts on food safety as a One Health issue, because climate change is a multidisciplinary challenge, which needs an integrated and a cross-sectoral response.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And obviously, you know, this is a chain reaction with any of these variables. You know, as you put it, it's a very complex issue. Now, one component of that, or rather one segment, I guess, how do you see the shrinking availability of water resources and the rapid warming of the ocean affecting food safety on a global regional basis?
Yeah, so water scarcity has become quite a known reality, with major cities across the globe having to deal with it. Lack of adequate water can compromise, for instance, hygienic conditions in food processing plants by altering how machines are sanitized or how workers, you know, if they have enough water to wash their hands. But these can be tackled with by kind of thinking in advance and putting measures in place. In the absence of adequate water, farmers may resort to irrigating crops with water that's taken from unsanitary sources, which of course increases our exposure to different biological and chemical hazards. There are technologies today that can be used to recycle water, which is of course getting a lot of traction. In some cities, there are various agricultural methods, like vertical farming, for instance, that are based on the hydroponic or aquaponic systems, where water can be recycled as one of the ways to conserve resources as we farm. But there is a need for stricter monitoring control systems for such water treatment before reuse or even release of this water after the agricultural practice is over. The oceans that are warmer and acidic have a lower capacity to absorb and store oxygen. So hypoxia, or lack of oxygen, is made worse by also the growing algal blooms issue. And a lot of these hypoxic regions appear in major fishing areas, which again increases our exposure to marine toxins through the consumption of seafood. Rising temperatures can also cause, as we have seen in the news all over, mass coral bleaching events. And that has food safety implications, as bleaching has been known to also be associated with increased outbreaks of Ciguatera, marine toxin poisoning. Also, methylation of mercury in water is temperature dependent. So warming oceans may increase our exposure to methylmercury by increasing how much of methylmercury is accumulated in different fish species. And also, if we kind of zoom out a little bit, increasing carbon dioxide concentrations and rising temperatures are also thawing our glaciers. So, and some of them quite irreversibly so. And this increases flooding risks. And these have impacts on downstream agricultural fields, effects on coastal communities, and even on infrastructure like water treatment plants that has to deal with this increased load. All of this will need to be made climate ready, in essence. And some of the island nations today are already grappling with these issues that are coming up with sea level increase.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of very heavy consequences to think about, definitely. So thank you for explaining all of those, Kaya. Now, I'd like to drill down on some specific issues here next. Now, in that December-January article that you wrote for us on applying foresight, you wrote that changes in temperature, precipitation, and other factors are affecting the geographic distribution and persistence of foodborne pathogens, such as Salmonella and Campylobacter, for which evidence is well documented. So it just kind of from a point of view of, you know, pathogen spread. Can you talk a little bit about the mechanics behind this trend and some of the evidence supporting it?
Thanks, Adrian. I'll take this one. And thanks again for having us today. Well, there is scientific evidence that support a strong and consistent positive association between higher temperature and the transmission of both Salmonella and Campylobacter infections. In fact, higher temperatures can enable a quicker replication of these pathogens. In addition, precipitation increases the chance of runoffs and therefore the pathogen loads in water resources, which if it's used to produce food, it can lead to foodborne illnesses, such as, for example, salmonellosis linked to papaya or cantaloupe. Studies have also found delays of around 2 to 4 weeks between hot days and high precipitation, with corresponding increase in salmonellosis, for example. Heat stress also can lead to enteritis in broiler flocks, potentially resulting in contamination of meat with salmonella. And also, I would like to say that various Campylobacter species are well known to survive a wide range of temperatures, for instance, by forming heat shock proteins. And greater pest activities, such as flies that are carriers of Campylobacter during warmer temperatures, can also lead to more infection. So at the end, I'd like to make the point that the infection by Salmonella and Campylobacter tend to be underreported, as medical attention is often not sought for them. So therefore, it's important that we have a better understanding of the burden of foodborne illness by such pathogens, as it can be much higher than what we are currently measuring. As such, we need more efforts to try to document these cases, especially as our climate is changing.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah, so we're seeing that these pathogens are not only adaptable, but they're going to be spreading faster with the warming climate. So that's definitely something to be concerned about as well. My next question, now mycotoxinogenic fungi and toxin-producing algae are rapidly growing threats as well. Now, how should growers and food processors respectively respond to these food safety concerns to protect public health?
Thanks. Also, well, you know, mycotoxin is one of these, unfortunately, everlasting issues in food safety. And really, mycotoxin can really impact both public health as well as economies and international trade. One of the critical ways to tackle these issues is by raising greater awareness of not only the health burden of mycotoxin exposure, but also how climate change is really altering the distribution and formation of these toxins. Greater monitoring of mycotoxin occurrence, coupled with investment into prediction models, can really help into preventing and reducing the entry of mycotoxin into the food chain. Technological advances, such as remote sensing, for example, can also allow operators to gather data on expected, unexpected weather conditions, early detection of pest damage, which in turn can help alleviate food safety risk imposed by mycotoxin. There is still room for better establishing and indeed then applying a One Health approach, as this is truly one example of a cross-cutting issues that gets across several disciplines. In addition, we need to have greater involvement of the health sector, more transparency in data sharing, more investment into research and development, especially in countries where these issues is really becoming a major threat due to climate change. We also need to rethink how we are actually storing and distributing major staple foods, like, for example, cereals and grains, in light of the warming climate.
All right, thanks so much for reviewing that, Vittorio. Now, in your Applying Foresight article, you also write about the promise that's offered by urban food systems to help feed the growing global population. And Kaya talked about this a little bit earlier. Now, these urban food systems include the growth of controlled environment agriculture, or CEA, you know, such as those hydroponic or aquaponic systems. And we've seen many new CEA operations start up over the past decade. Now, what food safety concerns do we need to be aware of with CEA operations? And, you know, given that we have seen already a few foodborne illness outbreaks associated with these types of operations.
Thanks. Also, a very important question, as we're getting a lot of attention also by the media on these new production systems. So I'd like to start off by saying that controlled environment agriculture can really come with some advantages, such as protection from the outdoor weather elements or even pests and wildlife. But it's not without its own challenges, some of which are quite similar to traditional ways of growing food, while others are quite specific to this type of farming and production. For example, humid, warm environments of indoor agriculture can really facilitate microbial growth, including foodborne pathogens. In fact, a number of outbreaks, as you also mentioned, have been linked to salmonella infection associated with leafy greens that have been produced by indoor hydroponic operations. There is also the need for better monitoring of water that is actually used in such systems to assure that the water is free of contamination. In 2021, so a couple of years ago, we have produced FAO and WHO a guidance document to determine if water is fit for purpose in the production of fresh fruits and vegetables. The guidance also outlines practical intervention that can be applied to reduce food safety risk when water does not meet the food for purpose type requirements. Finally, since this industry is growing and is growing very rapidly, there is a need for even more transparency and data sharing to prevent future issues from happening, really.
Okay, thanks, Vittorio. Now, I want to switch subjects a little bit for my last question for you. Now, the European Food Safety Authority, or EFSA, recently determined that the food safety of plastic polyethylene terephthalate, or PET as it's usually referred as, when produced by a process called polyrecycling for use in food contact materials, is safe. So in your article, you write about the growth of the circular economy and the promises and challenges of plastics recycling and bio-based alternative packaging and active and intelligent packaging. And you also note that there are food safety and allergen concerns related to these innovative food packaging technologies. So can maybe you expand a little bit on these concerns and what food processors need to be aware of moving forward as they plan their product designs and incorporating these new and innovative types of packaging?
Thanks, Adrian. You are touching on another very important emerging issues that we are all observing. And circular economy is increasingly recognized as one of the possible major solutions to address various global challenges. And plastic waste is most definitely among the biggest challenges that we are facing today. One of our recent reports showed that we use around 12.5 million metric tons of plastics in agriculture production in 2019, and such estimates are only expected to grow. So while food packaging plays a vital role in keeping food safe and reduces also food loss and waste, it can also contribute to the plastic waste problem. So to tackle these issues, there is growing emphasis on the recycling of the materials already in use. But there is currently less than 10% plastics recycled worldwide, and even so, most of the plastic can only be recycled for a limited number of times without compromising the quality of the end product. In fact, such lower grade plastics can be unfit for food applications due to contaminants that can arise during, for example, recycling of the process itself, as well as higher migration of chemicals into the food. So to avoid this, we need to redesign how we innovate and develop new materials. There is growing market for the use of bio-based materials in food packaging, with a niche space even for edible type packaging. These materials are considered to be more sustainable, environmentally friendly, though it's important to point out that not all the bio-based packaging is actually biodegradable. So moving on to the tox profiles that we are observing with these bio-based products, those are very close to the raw materials that are derived from. So for example, they can contain pesticide residues, heavy metals, mycotoxin, or even antimicrobial residues, for example. Another possible food safety concern with new bio-based material is the presence of established or even novel allergens, as you mentioned before, and in the material itself, and also the ability of these allergens to actually migrate into food. For instance, a variety of proteins currently considered or in use to produce different bio-based materials actually originate from soy, eggs, milk, or wheat, or even pea. So finally, I'd like to add that with respect to the edible packaging, which is another growing area of interest, since these materials are in direct contact with external environment, there is even an extra layer of precaution that needs to be considered to avoid contamination and make sure that the consumer are safe.
Great. Thank you so much, Vittorio. And very great insights from both you and Kea. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and speaking with us and informing our audience about, what we need to be concerned about as far as, the intersection of food safety and our warming climate and all of the different environmental considerations there. And then also, what we're looking at the intersection of food safety and sustainability. So I think, we've looked at some really interesting ideas today. And of course, all of this great foresight information that FAO offers, we'll be including links to all of that so that you can go and read more about this for yourself. But thank you, Kea and Vittorio, for this great interview. And we appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having us, Adrian.
Thanks a lot. And thank you for having us. It was a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Kaya Mukherjee and Dr. Vittorio Fattori for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. Please don't hesitate to send us your questions or suggestions to podcast@food-safety.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We're always glad to see your comments. To make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player, all you have to do is click that follow or subscribe button in the player of your choice and presto. And while you're there, please throw some stars our way by rating the podcast, especially if you enjoyed it. It only takes a moment and it's good for everyone. Okay, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on April 11th. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.